Good morning, everybody. We'll go ahead and get started. So welcome back. We are hopefully all alive, awake, alert, and enthusiastic about this morning. What did you say? It is Saturday morning. That's true. But we're still alive, awake, alert, and enthusiastic. So we're going to, toilets down the hall. If there's a fire, just please leave the building, out one of the doors. Tea, coffee, biscuits. So it's 10:15 now. We're going to go until 12, and then we'll break for lunch, or around 12 we'll break for lunch for around an hour, and then come back in. So Doug talked yesterday about a side lamp. So I brought in an example. So Denise does struggle with lack of sunlight, and so sometimes, especially during the winter here, it will affect her mood. And it does mine too a little bit. I'm not as much as Denise, but anyways, we got this lamp. You can get them off Amazon. They are a little expensive. This one was around 50 euros. And there are others. When you are looking around, there are other side lamps that will be much cheaper than that. And you do want a lamp that is full spectrum, is what it was called, Doug? Yeah, full spectrum. And if the price seems too good to be true, then it's probably not the right thing. And you can certainly go more expensive. You can get a nice floor lamp that puts out the full spectrum for, 250 euros. But this one works nice. As you can see, it is like staring into the sun. It doesn't give you a tan, though. Yeah, you still have to use the lotion for that. But this is what it is. If you want to look at it, feel free to come up during one of the breaks and look at it, or you can talk to me or Denise, and we'll tell you about it. But it's really easy to use. You can just set it on the table or on the desk by your computer while you're working, because it does have to make, like Doug said yesterday, it does have to make eye contact. So it can be a little distracting at first, but you get used to it, and it's fine to have while you're reading or plowing through your emails or whatever. So with that in mind, that's it. We'll go ahead and have Doug come up, and we will move on with the seminar.
It was not yesterday who needs handouts. We have two handouts. Yeah, she got them already. All right, good. Well, you're all wide-eyed, ready to talk about depression and suicide some more? I know it's a hard subject. We're going to pick up the outline on page 2, number 4. We were going over the 5 steps. We'll start there very briefly and then move on. I don't want to repeat myself too much. So again, remember the 5 steps of suicide thinking. First, a person wants to die. They're just tired of living. They want to die. It's kind of like, please God, take me out. And we see this in the Bible in multiple places where writers who were clear, like David in the Psalms, clearly depressed. And at times he says things like that he just wants God to take him out. He wants to go be with the Lord. Job said that. God, why did you make me? Been better you never made me. And that's the early stages of the depression and wanting to give up. And then depression continues, and if you remember the spiral we talked about, as the depression gets a little deeper, the thinking will change to begin, well, maybe I should end my own life. Now I'm not just waiting for God to end my life, but I'm thinking I want to get out of here. I just don't like this world. I don't like living here. And then as the thinking develops, they really begin to develop a plan. And a plan is a way they want to try to kill themselves. Some plans are very, very serious. And I gave you an example last night of a girl named Lisa. She and her friend had a very serious plan to take pills. I have a pastor I'm working with in counseling now, and you would think a pastor would never get suicidal, right? And this pastor had, he's married, has two children. He and his wife had a third daughter, and she died suddenly. Plus, his job at the church, they cut it way back, and he was afraid he was going to lose his job at the same time. And so because of that, he got so depressed and hopeless, he became suicidal. He developed a whole plan, and he didn't tell his wife or children, obviously, so he made sure that they were busy. He had the car. Nobody was expecting him. He had time away, and he picked a spot where he was going to drive and kill himself, and all of the plan worked out, and he drove all the way there to attempt to kill himself. And at that point, it was like God intervened, and he said, oh, I just can't do this. And he turned around and drove back. Well, the next day, he called me, and he and I started counseling. Now, so in that case, nobody stopped him. It was really the Lord speaking to him that stopped him, but he took it all the way there. And he was really scared to have to tell his wife what he had done. But obviously, he had to tell her. You can't keep that secret. And so anyway, that's when they make a plan. I have another man I'm seeing who carried out a plan and lived. And he was so disappointed. Like, and he's still today, and he's living a full life. He's married with kids and a good job, and he's a Christian, having a good life at this point. But he'll still say in counseling sometimes, I can't believe the plan didn't work. It was a perfect plan. And he's an engineer. He had engineered this whole thing to work just the right way. It was a highly developed plan. I talked to a teenage boy one time who said he wanted to kill himself. And I said, well, how would you do it? And he said, well, our next door neighbor has Doberman pinchers. Do you know what Doberman pinchers are? Kind of a mean dog, a guard dog. And these neighbors had two or three guard dogs. And he said, I'm going to jump over the fence and let the dogs kill me. Now, that's not a very good plan, right? First of all, most dogs are going to walk away. They're not going to bother. These were neighbor dogs. But it shows how desperate he was feeling. So the plan, depends on the plan, can get very, very serious. And then an actual attempt, when they can actually carry out with the plan, is obviously the suicide attempt. And remember, we said last night, there's about 25 suicide attempts for every one completed suicide. So lots of people even may attempt it, but not succeed for one reason or another. So it's a very serious problem. By the way, a couple more statistics. Men commit suicide about 4 times more than women do, but women attempt suicide about 5 times more than men. So women are more likely to actually think about it and attempt it, but men tend to be more assertive and aggressive and actually follow through as compared to women. But those are some things to be aware of, especially with a man. So last night under 4B, we talked about the progression. You'll begin to see changes in behavior. You'll begin to see people isolated a little bit. The depression is slowly getting worse. They're more and more withdrawn. They're smiling less. They're paying less attention to things, showing less interest in things. The changes in the behavior often at the beginning are pretty subtle. You don't see them very dramatically. They're very kind of just not themselves. And one of the worst questions people tend to ask a lot is, are you okay? Is everything all right? Do you know anybody who's ever honest with that answer? It's kind of like, oh, I'm fine. But so that's not the kind of question. You want to ask questions to draw people out. But you'll see changes in behavior, withdrawing, isolating. And often you'll see more and more anger building up. And anger will be sometimes held in, and they'll just have a more negative, kind of a bitter attitude. Sometimes it comes out more, and they're more irritable, they're more sharp, impatient, edgy. And when you see that anger building up, that especially, again, is a warning sign. They're holding feelings in. They're stuffing and holding feelings in, and they're building up inside, which makes people more and more dangerous. The more they carry inside, the more potentially dangerous they can actually be. And then we talked a lot about the hopeless and helpless. When people begin to feel hopeless and that it'll never be any different and it's always going to be like this, nobody will ever understand, this can never change, there's nothing I can do about it, the more hopeless the thinking becomes, and sometimes even verbally, you'll hear people express that way, the more you need to be concerned. These people are showing you indicators that they're in trouble, that there's a real potential for danger there. So anyway, that's a little bit of a review from last night. Did anybody have any questions on those things before we move on? So on page 3, at the top, yes. Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to give examples as we go along. Yeah. So, because people, as they're building up and holding feelings in, when you say, are you okay? They're going to say yes. If a rare person says no, then you've learned no information. You still don't know what they're feeling. But most people are going to lie at that point and say yes, even if they don't feel so good. So anyway, at the top of page 3, another thinking that goes on is they convince themselves everybody will be better off without me. You know, my family will be better off. I'm always so sad, so depressed, everybody's so worried about me. Everybody will be better off without me. And this is a very dangerous way of thinking because it makes it okay to hurt themselves. I've had multiple people say that. So I know if I kill myself, people will be sad for a while, but then they'll get over it and they'll be okay. And anyway, you know, I'm hard to live with and I caused my parents problem, my spouse. And so they begin the thought, you'll see a breakdown in their thinking. Their thinking patterns begin to break down. And in their mind, it's actually kind of like doing a favor, doing a good deed. To kill myself is a good deed. And there's that kind of thinking. Now, does anybody actually believe that? It's when people commit suicide, it isn't just like they died of old age. There's a pain that follows suicide for many years to come. My mother, who's now with the Lord, my mother had a brother who committed suicide when he was 40 years old. Shocked the whole family. Nobody expected it. And my mother died at age 88. And the whole rest of her life, she carried that pain. And you could just mention her brother's name and she would break down crying very quickly. Suicide, you don't get over. You don't grieve for a year and then you feel better. That's not how it works. Unfortunately, I have a brother, he's still alive. I have a brother who has some pretty serious emotional problems. And my brother figured out that was a tender spot in my mom. And so my brother figured out that all he had to do was threaten to kill himself. And because of all the pain my mom carried from her brother killing himself, she would do anything he wanted. And I would get so mad at my brother, how could you do this? But he said, if you don't give me this money, I'm going to kill myself. And my brother never tried to kill himself, but he would manipulate my mother that way because of how tender it was. So no, nobody's going to be better off if somebody commits suicide, no matter how serious the problems are. One way to think of suicide, one way I like to think of suicide, is it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. When you kill yourself, you're done. It's permanent. There's no correcting. But the problems, the emotional problems, the depression, the breakup, the trauma, those are temporary problems that if you get the right help, you can grow from. But there's no help for suicide. So it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And that's, you can never attempt suicide and be thinking rationally. You can't be thinking in a healthy way and conclude, yes, I think suicide is a good solution, a good option. There's no way to do that in a rational way. But you also see people giving up. I'm just not going to try anymore. They don't want to go to school. They don't want to go to work. Don't want to go to church. They don't want to go be with friends. They isolate. They stay in their room. They withdraw. Maybe they'll play a video game day after day. They just give up. They quit living life and withdraw. Be very concerned when you see people giving up and withdrawing like that. And when there's a lot of anger being expressed, again, that anger, it's a very simple thing to be angry at you and then turn it to myself. There have been a lot of studies done of teenagers, and when they attempt suicide, what kinds of things are teenagers thinking when they attempt suicide? And it's really bizarre, some of the thought patterns, because teenagers will sometimes, and there have been a lot of surveys, think things that when I kill myself, I'll show them. They'll be sorry when I kill myself. Now, is that strange? If you kill yourself, how do you know if they're going to feel sorry or not? Sometimes they'll think, if I kill, I want to see how they react when I kill myself. There's a lot of this strange thinking, especially teenagers can get into, that somehow it's like they think they're going to live beyond the suicide attempt and learn something or something. And it's adults don't tend to think that way, but younger people can think that way. So it's kind of like, well, I'll show them. You know, they'll be sorry, kind of like they're going to teach somebody a lesson, like it's going to be a helpful lesson. And then I talked about often you'll see risky behavior, and this is especially true of young people. And I gave one weird example about somebody I'm seeing. Often there's a lot of risky type behavior that begins to be employed. One of the comments made last night was about self-harming behavior. And here's an area where you'll see self-harming behavior. Self-harming behavior is when people cut themselves, when they burn themselves, when they, a lot of people, eating disorders where they punish their own body by starving themselves or being anorexic, not eating proper calories, or bulimic, where they eat and then they throw up to get it out of their body. Self-harming behaviors are where they're damaging their own body. And where there's cutting, where there's burning, any of those kinds of things are part of the risky behavior. When you ask people, usually what they'll do is they'll cut in places that are usually hidden from the general public. So they might cover and cut in their, often it's on their forearms, kind of behind where the sleeves would typically show, or the thighs where typically are covered up, sometimes the stomach, and people are hurting themselves doing these sorts of things. And when you ask them, why did you cut yourself? What they'll say is two different things. Sometimes when they cut, they'll say it kind of, I feel so bad, at least when I cut myself. I'm in pain, it hurts, because of my arm, not just because of my depression or my emotion. It's like it gives them a justified reason to feel pain. Sometimes, and burning is typically like that as well. Sometimes it's an attempt to die, obviously, passively. So if I develop an eating disorder and I just starve myself and just won't eat anything good, I'm trying to kill myself, but it's a more passive suicide. It's not quite as active. It'll take longer, but it's a very serious problem, very serious behavior people have. The other thing when people cut themselves especially is they'll say they're trying to get the bad out. It's kind of like blood. If blood comes out, bad somehow comes out with it. And if you find a friend or a family member who is self-harming, cutting or burning, please ask them, what are you doing that for? Don't think it's too sensitive that you can't ask them. It's really better to ask them and get them to talk about it. In counseling, when we suspect people are cutting or burning, we'll ask them, can you show me your arm? And, I vividly remember people where you would never know when they're dressed, but they, their normal clothes are on, it's covering it up. But when they roll up their sleeve and you see scars up their arm or burn marks. So these are risky behaviors, and it's a way of self-hate. They're taking their anger out on themselves. Now, the good news with self-harming is often people who self-harm aren't the biggest threat for the most serious suicide. They hate themselves so much they're taking their hate out on themselves. But it's a serious problem, and it's a sign of depression, serious depression. So this is where self-harming would be included in some of the risky kind of behavior. Risky behavior, it could be skydiving, it could be rock climbing without the proper training, it could be any number of things, driving too fast down the roads, behaviors that really are looking for an acceptable way to die. It's really not acceptable, but it looks a little more natural. And in America, at least, most men have life insurance policies. And this is something that a lot of times men in America who are suicidal, they'll justify, well, if I kill myself, they'll get all my life insurance and my wife and kids will be better off without me because they'll have more money. Now, insurance plans don't pay if you kill yourself. If I kill myself, my wife wouldn't get my life insurance policy. But if I make it look like an accident when really it wasn't, then it's a way men will rationalize, well, at least then my wife will get the money and she'll be better off without me. Sounds strange? But that's a rationalization. That's a negative way of thinking that gets justified. So as this kind of spiral begins, that's usually when the planning process for people begin. Okay, now it's time. I need to end my life. I don't want to live anymore like this. And where people get more and more suicidal in developing a plan. And then often their worldview gets so negative and hopeless that often they'll start feeling better as they develop a plan. And we mentioned this briefly last night. Now that I made a plan, I've made up my mind, now all of a sudden I can be more friendly, it's like, okay, I've got a plan in place, I'm ready to go, I've made up my mind, and so people can actually kind of perk up a little bit. If you think of depression, which we talked some about last night, where when people are feeling more or less normal and then they go through a period of depression and that depression gets deeper and deeper, and then for one reason or another, as they begin to come out of the depression and go a little bit more back to normal, and they're feeling better, and they're still depressed, but they have a little more energy. They don't just lay in bed all day. They have a little more energy to get out and do some things. This is the highest risk of suicide. If you know somebody and they're going deep into depression, this is not where they're most likely to try to kill themselves. They're most likely going to try to kill themselves as they seem to get out of the depression and be feeling better. Why do you think that is? Yeah, have energy. It takes energy to kill yourself. When you're this depressed, you can't even function. But as you come out the other side and you get energy, it's easier to do physically. You can implement your plan. We just had a sad situation of this in our church back home, where a man who had some mental illness, and he was an older man, he was actually an eye doctor, very educated, very successful, married with children, adult children now. And he had been suicidal in the past, and he was in the hospital several times and came out, and he seemed to be doing a lot better, and he was talkative, and I was even at an event the day before with him and his wife. We're at an event at our church, and he was chatty and smiling and normal and friendly, and we were joking around with each other, and the next day he killed himself. And he gave off no signs. Now, in that case, I didn't deal with him real personally, so I wasn't involved in that. But had you gone to the church social, you would have thought, oh, he's great. He's in a good mood. He's happy. He's friendly. He and I were talking about retirement. I mean, that kind of implies like he was thinking about the future, what his life would be like, when really this is where he was. The truth is, he had made up his mind he was going to kill himself and how he was going to do it. And so he felt better because he knew the next day he would do it. So this is the time to be especially careful when people have been depressed or suicidal and all of a sudden they seem to be doing a lot better. Talk to them. Ask questions. How are you doing? You know, in terms of what they're really functioning. Are you sleeping okay? Remember some of the self-care things we talked about. Are you talking to somebody? How depressed are you? You want to ask those kinds of questions. Don't just assume, well, they seem fine, so they are fine. That's not necessarily the truth. So when you see people spiraling, getting more and more depressed, more and more suicidal, let's talk for a minute about what are some of the wrong things to do. If you want to do some of the wrong things, what would they be? Gee, somebody's suicidal. What are the worst things to do? Well, here's a wrong thing to do. Say, stop it. What is wrong with you? Knock it off. It's not that bad. Why would that be wrong? Well, you're not listening. You're telling. And you're condemning. You're judging. You're criticizing. You're condemning. That doesn't help. In fact, it can make it worse. What's another wrong thing? Oh, you don't really feel that way. Has anybody ever told you that? You're upset and they come to you and say, oh, you don't really feel that way. Now, wait a minute. I actually do feel that way. And here you're telling me I don't feel that way. Oh, you don't really feel suicidal. You don't really feel that depressed. And telling people what you think they should or should not feel is always the wrong thing to do. Sometimes in Christian circles, we'll use the Bible against people. And, you know, if you kill yourself, you're going to go to hell. Or God's going to be mad at you. Now, we can talk about the theology around this some and what the Bible teaches about some of this. If we have time, we'll do that later this afternoon. But telling people if they kill themselves, they'll go to hell is not helpful. I don't think as a Christian you can even honestly make a statement like that, but it's sure not helpful. The other thing a lot of family members will do is think there's nothing they can do about it, kind of give up. I attended a workshop on depression and suicide, and the psychologist showed a video, and it was the most tragic video of about an 18 or 19-year-old boy who ended up killing himself. And they followed him in the show. He did like a video of his life in the process. And it, both of his parents had abandoned him. He was kind of living alone. He had a grandma who was the one person who loved him. And one of the scenes was of this boy talking to his grandma, saying he just couldn't stand living anymore. He just didn't want to live anymore. And grandma just sitting there saying, "Oh, you know, I'm sorry." And that was it. Like she didn't do anything. He went and talked to her for a little while, but eventually he did leave and kill himself. And it's tragic when people think, well, there's nothing I can do. I mean, I don't know how to help people. There's nothing I can do about it. One behavior you'll see with suicidal people often is called flinching. Flinching is when they like move to try to kill themselves, and then they get scared and they back off and they kind of stop for a while, and then they move toward trying it again and go back and forth. And part of that is to build up the courage or the commitment to actually try to kill themselves. And this video of this young man showed a lot of flinching, where he actually would go and consider how he would kill himself and kind of go check it out and think about it, and then he'd pull back. And then he'd talk to his grandma, and she didn't give him any hope, didn't tell anybody, didn't do anything. She just kind of bought into the idea that there was just nothing she could do. So that flinching, moving toward suicide and then backing away, is something that you'll see. Anyway, back to another wrong thing to do is, don't you love us? How could you do that to us? Don't you love us after all we've done for you? Again, anything that creates shame or guilt or condemnation like this is the wrong thing to do. It's not going to help. In fact, it could do the opposite. Any of you have any examples of wrong things to do? What's that? Not believing? That would be another example. Oh, you don't really feel that way. You just said that. If somebody says they're suicidal, please take it very, very serious. Don't ever tell yourself, oh, they're just trying to get attention. Don't ever tell yourself something like that. Always take it serious. My brother, we had to take it serious when he said he'd kill himself, even though we knew he was trying to get money out of my mom and dad, or get them to feel sorry for him. But still, you have to take it serious. I mean, this is a person's life that we're talking about. So there's a whole series of positive steps, and that's what I want to do next. But we're at a nice little break point, so we're gonna take a couple-minute break, and then Lori Cole's going to come up. Lori teaches, works, and leads the children's department at our church. Our church in Colorado is, what, over 1,000 people, and so we have lots of families, lots of children, several hundred children, and Lori and her team, she has a team working with her, lead the children's programs, an Awanas program. They do a vacation Bible school program where like 500 children come to. So Lori has a lot of experience, a lot of responsibility. She's worked at the church in that job for 12 years now. She's got a college degree in social work, very qualified to do this. So she's going to come and share something on social media, about social media, with all of you. So we'll take about a 5-minute break and use the toilets or help yourself to something to drink. And then Lori will start us up in a few minutes.
Okay, we're going to sit down. You guys ready? I've already got these girls who are going to talk. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, don't you worry. That's why you guys are in front row. And don't be moving. I saw those eyes. Okay, so now don't roll your eyes when I say we're going to talk about social media. Okay? The parents will appreciate it. All right. A little bit about me, too, that you guys should know is the gentleman back there who's really quiet is my husband. And we have three boys. I know. There was not a girl to be had. So, one thing about boys, that the boys, you can nod your head. You don't like to go and talk to your mom a lot, do you? Be honest. Okay. You talk to your mom a lot? Oh, so she's blessed. That's good. Also, excuse my coat, but I'm really cold. So just be like, it's okay. All right. So I'm going to ask you guys a question, and I want you to answer me. And if you guys don't answer me, and I'm talking to all of you, I'm going to make these guys answer. Okay? So how many of you have sent an email thinking, okay, I'm going to interact with this person, and I'm going to write down all my thoughts so that my communication is really clear, and it's gone south. It's gone really bad. None of you? Be honest.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so our interaction, let's be honest also. How many of you have a phone? How many of you have your phones here? Mm-hmm. See what I'm saying? Okay, so our interaction tends to be like this with people, doesn't it? Right? Our heads are down. We're looking at our phones or we're on our computers. So we would rather send an email than meet with someone sometimes because we think, oh, email's faster. Let's just talk on email, right? Or let's, you know, do the WhatsApp, okay? Or we sometimes tend to text, then call some. Okay, here's what I want to say. If someone's calling you on the phone, who's calling you? Your mom. You don't call each other, do you? You WhatsApp each other, don't you? Or FaceTime, right? But when you hear your cell phone ring, you teens know who it is, right? Like, you don't even do... Okay, so, like, I'm one of those moms that I have all the fun ringtones for the different people. And my children are like, why do you have different ringtones? Like, when the phone rings, it's you. So, like, they don't even have a ringtone for me. Because I am the only one who will call them. And then here's what's really fun. And I want to ask you guys this. When your mom calls and leaves you a message, do you listen to the message? No. So parents, do not leave a message. Just show that you called. And they're gonna text you back. And they're going to say, what's up? Right? Okay. So this is where we at. Okay, see, I totally have their number. I only have your number because my kids do this to me. Okay? So I have figured out if I really want to get a hold of my boys, I text them. And I text them in capital letters because you guys know that's shouting, right? Call me now. Okay? And still, I have one son, my middle son, who thinks the telephone is an inconvenience. Like, it's not an inconvenience when he wants to use it, but whenever I'm using it, I am not kidding you. I will do the call me now, and then 2 days later, hey, did you need something? And I think, well, it's a good thing my car wasn't stuck or whatever. So this is where we're at, right? We have all these really cool gadgets right at our side. But I want you to think for a minute what that does for someone who is feeling left out of a community, okay? So this is how we talk to each other. And you have your group. You have your group on Facebook. You have those people you want a friend, and then you have those people that you ignore, right? And you're like, ooh, I don't even want to accept this. So you just leave it in the ignore spot, right? So then you have a person who's on the outside looking in, and they want to be on your Facebook. They want to be doing Instagram with you. Do you guys do Snapchat? Is that your favorite? Those that are on social media. Are you all on social media? Most of you? Is it because your parents don't let you? Is it? Tell your parents thank you. All right? Seriously. Okay, something I want to tell you guys about Facebook. Facebook is for us moms now. Did you know that? I hate to tell you parents, but like you guys are the college students back there, right? Do you guys do Facebook? Yeah? Do you do Facebook because of people who are far, far away? Yeah? My kids tell me, now I have a 30-year-old, I have a 28-year-old, and a 22-year-old. He's 28, right? Nope, he's 27. I don't even know. That was an awesome moment for me. Steve's like, you know, I push him out and then it all gets lost. So they tell me that Facebook is for the moms. Like, oh, we are so not on Facebook anymore. People have moved to Instagram, and then they've even done the WhatsApp is real popular. The Snapchat, that seems to be the go-to. Twitter doesn't even seem to be, I don't know, do you guys do Twitter? Yeah, see, they're like, no. So us people who did not grow up with cell phones or computers, we think Facebook is the bomb, okay? But we're so out of it because we say the bomb, and you guys are like, oh, don't even say those words. Okay, so, but I do want you guys to think a moment on when you are even spending time on social media and you put something up and it's like you take a while to take this picture. You think about it for a long time because you want the likes, right? Come on, we all go for the likes. And then we even go back and we see how many people liked our stuff. Because I know of some teens who have told me if they don't get so many likes, they take it off. Because then it doesn't look good. So we're really out there wanting that acceptance in social media. So for someone who is feeling really isolated, very depressed, this will spiral down, okay? Because they're looking for the acceptance of the likes. They're looking for that one funny way to tag it so that people will be like, ooh, ah. And they will feel, what did I say wrong? They will feel like they're on the outside looking in if they don't get the right response. Now, when you're talking to someone face to face, you can get the response right away, can't you? You read their body language. You see their eyes roll. You get the, and then you know you're going the wrong direction. On an email, like I had asked earlier, you think that you've said everything correctly, you've spelled it all out, and then you get this response back that is like, I wasn't even going that direction. They can't read your inflection in your voice. They can't see that your exclamation point was excited, not angry. They can't see the big smile that you have on your face when you're like, that's a great idea. What they see is what they're feeling at that moment. Maybe it's a situation that you've brought up that's kind of hard for that person. So then they're responding with their emotions, but they can't see your face. So you're going to get a lot of this through the social media feed too. So what happens with someone who's isolated, getting depressed, is they spiral down and now they're going to spend more time. They're going to spend more time on social media because this is where it feels comfortable. I can hide behind this, right? I can hide into my phone, okay? All of us pull out our phones when we're waiting in line, right? There's nothing to do when you're waiting in line but to look at your phone. Do you guys ever stop and, like, look around, see what's going on? When you're standing in line. Yeah? Good. I want you to be aware of your environment because many people are wanting to pull away, and it's really easy to do it with our feeds, okay, where we sit. Who likes us far, far away? Social media is great. It keeps us interacting with one another. I went 2 years ago to Poland. I still have friends from Poland that I can talk to on Instagram. I can still see how they're doing. So, I mean, there's some great stuff about social media. So don't let yourselves leave saying this is evil. okay? But it's an easy place to fall into. And it's something I want you guys to be aware of when you see someone who is withdrawing. Begin to see if you see them texting more, if you see them, if you have Instagram, if you have Facebook, that you see them on there and they're constantly, constantly putting stuff on. The other thing I want you guys to be aware of is in behind a computer, behind your phone, sometimes a personality will act different. So I'll give an example. I know this young man and really nice guy, really easy to talk to, really loves the Lord. And when he gets behind a computer, it's almost like you get a different person. He tells a lot of personal information about himself, which it's like, ooh, he wouldn't say that to our faces. He really puts down a lot of his anger, and then he draws you into it and will be like, I feel this way because of dot, 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 but he won't say it. And so it's something that I had to work through with this gentleman. And what was interesting to me was he was in total agreement. Oh no, you should never put that stuff on. You never should talk like that. You should always talk like you would face to face. On your computer, on your phones. And yet, for some reason, being able to hide behind a screen, he would give you a total different person. And it would surprise people constantly. His pictures would surprise people. It would be like, that's not the person I see. So it's almost like you can live two different lives when you get drawn into kind of hiding yourself, but then you're telling more of yourself. People also will make the mistake of sharing too much information, like I said. People trust what they read. And so they will read something about you or they'll read something about someone else, and that is where they will make their decision on you. So you can put on a goofy photo of yourself or whatever, and then someone may think, wow, they're really different. I don't know about them. So who we present in social media needs to be the person that we present to everyone else. I want to give you guys some ideas of things that can happen in social media where we find people that need to go to counseling, where they realize, I probably should have talked to someone in the beginning. I know of a gal who was on Facebook when Facebook was cool, and the other thing that you need to know, which I know you guys know, you probably can do it. There's a lot of hacking that can happen. You can ask your parents. They have to be really careful with all the stuff that they do, bill-wise and that kind of stuff, because things can hack easily. Just lots of information can be taken. But people feel very comfortable. They're at home. They're in their comfortable room. They're in their safe spot at home, and then they allow themselves to give more information on the computer than they should. So this gal had a friend that she had given her password to her Facebook because friends share everything. These two like to share clothes. I mean, so why wouldn't you share your password, right? I mean, we are best friends. As Doug was saying, temporary issue, right? Us girls like to be mean to one another sometimes. So these two friends fell out of had a situation over a boy, surprise. And the friend took the password and started using her Facebook like she was being her. Okay. So the friend was trying to act like the girl. Okay. And she started putting stuff on her Facebook that was not true of what this gal believed, how she thought. Being best friends, they took goofy pictures of each other, pictures that they wouldn't have shared with other people. She started putting that on her Facebook. So the girl looks on her Facebook and finds all this stuff that is not true about her, that is actually stuff that she became very, very embarrassed of. And in that moment, she was like, I don't see you getting out of this. I don't see how tomorrow could be better at all because of what has been said. And all these people thought it was her. And people were responding going, I can't believe you feel that way. I can't believe you put that picture on. And so the stuff that started rolling in on her computer was so much for her to handle. And she didn't tell anybody because she was embarrassed. And it put her in a spot where she thought, my only way out is to be gone. I need to find a way out of this. And her out was not to tell her mom, was not to tell a friend. She didn't feel like she had any friends. So many of her friends had responded so negatively to what had happened to her. She wasn't, you know, she didn't know to put a disclaimer. This was not me. Nobody, you know, get off my feed because they could hack into yours, that kind of thing. In that moment, she was like, all I can do is be out. And she went to her mom's cabinet. She swallowed a lot of pills. She did not succeed, which was a good part of the story. But it was a hard climb up for her. And she wouldn't share with her parents right away when they had taken her to the hospital and they were, you know, had to pump her stomach and she had to be at the hospital for a while. And she would not share because when she finally shared, she said, it's my fault. And I think it's very easy because it's your item. It's what you opened up that she believed it was her fault. And so therefore, I am not going to share with anyone because I did this to myself. It took her a long time to figure out. Bad idea to share your password, but that's as far as you can go with that. The rest of it was stuff that was taken from her. That's called cyberbullying. Okay, our bullying that happens, and bullying seems to be coming stronger and stronger. And we get it face to face. People are very bold. People have been saying, will say things about you, and it will come to you. And if you go up to that person, there's, you know, either it can go, oh, I never said that. Or it can be like, yeah, I said that, and we all believe it. Face-to-face bullying, that's another, hurts your heart, can't take it away. You take it with you for a very long time. It's hard to let go of things that are negatively said about you. But in cyberbullying, your phone, your smartphone goes with you. Your computer's with you. You can erase it, but it feels like it's always there. And it comes up again and again because this person who is doing that to you is hiding in a sense. Whereas when you're on, let's say you're face to face and a group of kids are being really mean to one guy and they're making fun of him and they're taking his lunch and they're laughing, you know, horrible situation. But that guy can go home and he can be in a safe environment. He can be with his parents who tell them that he loves him. He can go to youth group and feel included. But if you start, if the cyberbullying comes through the social media, it's like it's always there. And you're afraid to pick up your phone because what's the next feed going to say? And this is becoming a bigger problem. This is where kids are wanting to harass and embarrass one another. And so who we are face-to-face will sometimes change who we are when we're typing things out. And this is where you're finding many kids are struggling with their self-worth because parents and youth leaders and your friends want to just pour into you and say how amazing you are and how fun you are to be around and the positive of who you are. And then you just have this, some people have this huge feed of negativity of, I want to be so much like that person. All of us compare ourselves to each other. I mean, we just do that as humans, right? In social media, I want you guys to remember, I personally, do you guys put up pictures of what you look like right in the morning? Be honest. Say no. Okay. So, I want to show you this. Doesn't this guy, oh, we can't see him. Hello, sir. Oh, there it is. Okay. So, this guy looks pretty cool, doesn't he? Like, you know, he's standing there. It's got a little breeze going on. And so, we all look at this picture and we go, wow, he's looking good. But then if you really look at the picture, do you think that's a wise choice? Right? So, again, you know, like, you look at that and you go, wow, that's a really cool idea. I would never do that. Don't, any of these things you see, don't do at home. Okay. So then you look at this guy and you're like, oh my gosh, he's an amazing swimmer. I mean, like, I wonder how long it took him to take that really cool picture, right? And you're like, oh my gosh, how cool. And then you go, So I need you guys to be thinking, we're all showing this little snapshot of ourselves and what's really going on behind us, okay? So you got this gal, she's enjoying life. She's like thinking she's so cool, but then let's really look. Up comes the bear, right? So those are the things I want you guys to be aware of. Like, we're only going to show what we want people to see. And those who feel like you're comparing to one another, you're going to see the picture that I showed in the beginning. You're going to see, man, they got their life together. They have really good ideas. They seem like they have fun all the time. And then if we were to be able to see the big picture, we would see that they are so much like us, that they struggle with hurt, that they feel like they compare themselves to others. You know, that they're in it with us too. And so what we do is we kind of go to the social media and we think, oh, I want to be like that girl and be really cool. And then we think, I would not want to stand where she's standing right now, right? I do have to say, I found these on Dangerous Selfies. So let's not do Dangerous Selfies. But I just want to give you guys an example of what happens when, if you focus too much on what that person looks like on social media and not spending time with who they are really. So a couple of ideas, and I'm not sure, did we have a, there we go, okay. So a couple of ideas, if you have a friend who is starting to pull away, starting to isolate, I think a really good thing would be to ask them, you know, how much are you spending on social media? You know, or you might hear them talking, oh, hey, did you see so-and-so's Facebook? Did you see all the things she was saying? You know, oh, wow. And then I saw this other guy's. And then you kind of hear that this person has been just sitting there for a long time, like hours upon hours, that they kind of know what's going on in everyone else's life better than, you know, like your best friend. And you're like, I didn't even know. She didn't tell me that. They're not interacting. This has become their interaction. This is where they're sitting. And sitting too long on this causes you to do what? I have a question for you guys. Do you make a rule that there is no phones at the table? Yep. Perfect. Do you guys follow that rule? Yeah. Is it like there's a basket you have to throw your phones in, or, you know, your parents give you that eye kind of thing and you like slide it down? I see that happens. Okay. All right. You college students, you know, you don't have someone telling you to put your phone down. When you friends are around the table, are you guys like this? Yeah. 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 No, that's they're like, no. Okay, so I have to tell you what's really funny. You know, my husband and I have three adult children now, and they will come over for their protein, for that good meal, for that free meal, because we all like free meals, right? So even though two of our boys are married, they still like to come for food they didn't have to buy, okay? And that's always a good thing. You guys will figure it out when you're on your own dime. You're going to be like, oh, mom is awesome. So we have... we have these adult children and they do these amazing things in the world. And we get around, it's usually on a Sunday, and we're around the table and we look around and we're like, and the phones are out, you know, and they're, oh yeah, yeah, you know, and they're not really talking. And I'm like, hello. But what's hard is we had that rule when they were younger, but now that they're older, they think that rule doesn't matter because, you know, I have my own house. I drive my own car, that kind of thing. This is my phone. So it becomes interesting. So be prepared. Put the seatbelts on. You need that interaction time. You need that face-to-face time. So when you're on social media, when you're texting, give yourself a timer. Help your friends have a timer. The more time you can spend face-to-face, look how cute these two are sitting here. It's because of the interaction they have had face-to-face. It's not because they became best friends on Instagram. Let's say Instagram, right? It's because of the time that they spend together. Those that are married, can you imagine dating just by texting each other? You know, some of us say, huh, I wouldn't have known some of the things I found out. But it wouldn't have gone real far. It's just not deep. What social media does is it keeps the relationship at a status quo. We want ups and downs, honestly, in a relationship. You have to work at your relationships. We can't do that here. The other thing is when you see someone on social media and you see that someone has responded poorly, I challenge you to ask them, is this a common thing that happens? Do you get responses like this from friends? And if it is someone you know, I encourage you to even maybe put a positive on top of the negative. How many of you can remember something bad that was said about you 3 months ago? Raise your hands. Be honest. Okay, how many of you can remember something that was said good about you 3 months ago? Yeah. So we do not hold on to the positive as long as we hold on to the negative. I can tell you, I remember a teacher who told me in high school, and I'm way past high school, that I wasn't going to graduate from high school. And I can tell you what she was wearing. I can tell you where I was standing. I can tell you how I felt all the way walking home. But I cannot tell you about the teacher in high school that said she really, you know, he or she really enjoyed my work. Like, I can't remember that. I got grades, right? But I can't remember a teacher saying that. But boy, I still remember. I remember that teacher's first and last name. I know what she's doing right now, honestly, because there's just this feeling of hurt, right? So the negative we hear and the negative we read, again, we believe everything and we believe it about ourselves. So we need our community to tell us otherwise. So you need to pour into those people that you're seeing on social media, that there's a negative feed, that there's a negative response, that there's an unkind word. And how you want to do that is you want to reach out to them. You want to do it face to face. You want to give them what they need. But if you can't, then you need to put a positive response to them on top of that negative. And of course, I'm going to challenge you guys with something. Just because your peers do social media, should you? Now, some of you have awesome parents and says you're too young for social media. I think that's very wise. You know, there is not a G-rated or a rating for social media like movies are. Like, it really helps some of the parents to figure out, okay, I'm not going to take my 4-year-old to PG-13. Okay? They don't have that. Do you know that even some of the games that are very popular on the phones should a 8-year-old probably shouldn't do. But there's no rating. And so some parents, you know, I have to be honest with you. How do you keep kids quiet? How do some parents keep kids quiet that are younger? Now, you guys are awesome. You're amazing. And I want to say that there were some other younger kids here that were like incredible. But most parents will take their phone out, they'll put the game on, and the child will stay quiet. There are some things that even five-year-olds have been able to trip up on in their parents' feeds. So I challenge you guys to not do social media just because other people do. Here's a big one. Do you think you could go a day without your phone? If you what?
If I had people to talk to.
If you had people to talk to. Oh, sure. Could you spend time by yourself without your phone? Uh-oh. Yes, I have a yes. I have a yes. The girls are kind of looking at me like, you got to be kidding me. That's how attached we are, right? Okay, how many of us run out the door and we're like, where is my phone? I can't get in the car without my phone, right? Okay, here's what's really funny. I'm gonna blow you guys away. You ready? Front row? You're in the splash zone. You ready? I grew up without a cell phone. I know, right? I mean, my parents had to wait to hear from me when I got home, right? They didn't get to be like how Steve and I were able to do. Did you get there? Are you safe? Are you in a ditch? You know, how like we want to be. And then of course, like I told you, my parents don't respond. I mean, my boys don't respond back. So it made it even worse. And with a phone, we're even more anxious because we're like, we didn't hear back. We didn't hear back. And I'm like, how did my parents do it so well? Maybe they didn't do it so well and they just fooled me. But so I want to challenge everyone to encourage those that you see just bogged down in social media. Encourage them to take a day away. So if you had a day away without your phone, what would you do? Anybody, throw things out. Read. Good job. What else would you do? Meet friends. Yes. These two are going to meet. You're not included. What's another thing you can do? I don't know. It's really pretty out there. What else could you do? Strolling around, right? Is there something you've always wanted to do that you've never done? Besides the things that you can't. That doesn't count. So, be that friend to that person. As Doug was saying, you know, energy's low, right? You can get them out for 5 minutes, get them off their device, spend time with them, bring them cookies or biscuits, sorry. You know, take them to the cinema, right? Because at the cinema, afterwards, you always have to talk about the show, right? And some people talk during the show. But that's not these guys. So these are some ideas that we need to be really aware of when someone is falling into a depression. I want to end it with, we have a child. I can't tell you which one because I promised him confidentiality, but he is related to me. And he really struggled on social media. It was a very hard place for him to be. It was one of those things that probably... he shouldn't have gotten social media until he was 30. This one is not 30. That's all I'm going to say. So, but as a parent, we didn't know that. We didn't know how much social media was going to change his personality. And he was one of those that would find himself saying things he shouldn't say, found himself liking things that wasn't a good idea because once you like something, then your social media commercialing feeds come up and it's like, oh, that's not me. So there was things that were opened up to him that shouldn't have been opened up to him because of the things he allowed to come through. When he was in high school, he struggled to find out his identity. Wasn't sure exactly where he fit in. wasn't the cool kid and wasn't the brainiac, wasn't the athlete, but wasn't the druggie, right? You have your extremes. So he really struggled with who am I, and tried to make a new person in his social media feed, which then was a lie of who he is. So he ended up having a group of friends who made fun of him and who bullied him in his text and on his Facebook. And he did not share that with us. We were not aware of that. We would check his stuff, but like most people, he knew how to get rid of that. So we didn't go deep into his stuff to try to find it. You know, we had the passwords. We became friends with him, you know, that kind of stuff. But there's some stuff that kids know how to navigate and send messages that others can't see. What happened was he had a group of friends that told him he really should kill himself. That no one will miss you. You are, you know, you don't fit anywhere. You're a bothersome. And he began to believe this of himself. He heard it so many times. Now, he's an adult that is still struggling with what was told to him in high school. That this is something that he continues to have to climb out of. Because he allowed it for too long, honestly. But for us as parents, we were not as aware of it as we needed to be. There was just some stuff that I was not, as his mom, be able to grab. Also, like I told you, my boys, I would pull, but I still wouldn't get the whole story. I knew something was up. I was praying for him. I knew that he needed, you know, a best friend in his life. It wasn't being provided. I was like, hello, Lord, do you hear me? But God sees him. God knows him. God loves him. And he is beginning to grab a hold of that. So even in the best of families, and I'm not trying to say I have a perfect family, but in a family where God is very important to us, where we pray over our children, where we love on our children, we had a child who had to think about, maybe I'm not worth being here. So what I want to do for you guys is you to be aware of those that are out there. Like Doug was saying, they look great. They look like they are having the time of their life. And this is one boy, if you met him, you would think life is carefree for him. But you don't know that bigger picture. He's not going to show you that bigger picture of hurt and brokenness. And so we need to be aware that what we see on social media is just that small little speck of what someone's working on. So what you guys can give to those people is you can give them a community, and you can give them someone face to face that will knock on the door and knock on the door till they come out and see you. That's the kind of running after that sometimes we need to do for people. So, and remember my challenge. Take one day this coming month, because March is almost done. So let's go for April. I want all of you in this room to take one day and you do not do anything with your phone or your computer. These guys are whispering about if that's even possible. Now, I just want you to know, your parents might be able to do a little bit easier, but that's because they're wiser. But if you ask them, they'll help you. Okay? Think you can do that? I don't know. They're deciding if they want to do it. All right. Thanks, guys.
Lori, that was good, huh? She knows what she's talking about. Computers and phones and technology are like cars. You get behind them and your personality changes. Is there a problem with, we call it in America, road rage? Is there a problem with road rage in Ireland? Road rage is when you start driving a car and just because you're behind a car, you think you're Superman or Superwoman. and you have superpowers. And it's like your personality changes. All of a sudden, you're angry, you're controlling. What does that crazy driver think they're doing? Get out of my way. And the computers and phones and technology are like that. You can change your personality. So that was great what Lori said. We're going to pick up on Roman numeral 6, and we're going to spend the rest of our time talking about what are the right things to do. We've been talking about depression, anger, feelings, a lot of those kinds of things. And I want to make sure we spend the rest of the time talking about what are the right things to do. And then this afternoon, after lunch, as we finish, we'll go back over the test that you each took. And we'll go through and see what the correct answers, the most helpful answers are. So what are the right steps to take when somebody is depressed, angry, you're really concerned that they may be in danger? What are the right things to do? Well, remember, first of all, that these hard feelings, it'll never get any better. Being depressed often are acute, meaning very limited period of time. If you can help people through the deepest, hardest time, usually they're going to start feeling better a little bit after. So remember that the focus really needs to be right away, immediate, and have some patience and commitment to go through a period of time with people. So when you begin to notice depression signs, what are some good things to do? Well, number one, ask people what are their feelings. Now, I don't know how the Irish are, much less all the different cultures represented here. Some cultures will talk about feelings openly. It's okay to talk about feelings. Some cultures, you don't talk about what you feel. And so sometimes it's hard for people to draw out what they're feeling. But I said earlier what some of the questions are that aren't helpful. Like, are you okay? Yes. No. Any question that ends in yes or no is a bad question. So when you want to start drawing people out of what they're feeling, you always want to ask a question that has a question mark behind it, and it's going to take words to answer. And I tell my clients, and this is true in marriage too, if you're trying to have a stronger marriage, this is good too. I always tell people you have to ask 3 questions before you give anybody an answer. Always ask at least 3. They can be any 3. So when somebody seems depressed and they make a statement, one of the problems people often make is they answer or respond too quickly. Well, I'm really depressed right now. Oh, well, come on, let's go do something. Or, no, don't be like that. Or, why? Why would you feel that way? I find why questions to be almost useless. Because when I tell you why, what have I gained? What have I learned? How have I been helped? So, you know, when I'm driving, when I get up in the morning and try to turn my car on, and the engine doesn't start, I am going to ask myself why. Why won't the car start? Because it helps me think about what the problem might be, so when I fix it, I can get my car to start. Why questions are good for practical things. If a recipe turns out bad and you're disappointed with the meal, okay, why did that happen? It may help you figure out what part of the recipe didn't work right. But in relationships, why questions are completely useless. Well, why do you feel that way? I don't know. I just feel that way, you know, or some of the things we've talked about, because it'll never get any better or whatever. So you want to ask 3 questions that are open-ended and about their feelings. So somebody, you might say something like, you know, it seems like you're pretty sad right now. I'd love to know, what are you thinking? What's bothering you right now? But you have to ask 3 questions before you even answer. Now, there's nothing sacred about 3. I made that up at one level. Now, I always justify it by saying the Trinity, you know, God the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, three is good. But ask three because you're getting them talking and listening. Kind of like what Lori was showing you in the picture. Seems like a happy picture until you get it bigger and then there's a bear back there or a shark. Asking three questions is like that. You're going to start drawing people out and understanding much more clearly what they're thinking or feeling. But more important than that, who else is listening to their answers? They are. And a lot of times, getting people talk, they hear themselves, and that they hear themselves speak it out loud. Now, some people, like I said, just aren't very good at feelings. So this is, I brought an example of a feeling chart I'll sometimes give to people when they say, well, I don't know what I'm feeling. I'll sometimes give them a chart like this, and it has faces with different emotions on it. I could leave this out if you want to see it, but I'll leave one with Russ and Jason. But sometimes I'll say, take a look at this and pick out two or three things you're feeling and tell me what they are and what they feel like for you. That's another one way to ask an open-ended question. But you want to ask open-ended questions to let them talk at a deeper level so you can learn more and so that they can hear their own thinking, their own reasoning. Well, I'm really depressed. I don't see any reason to live. Nobody will ever like me. It'll never be any different. So I say, okay, Doug, you need to ask three questions before you say anything. And I do. I'll tell myself that. So what are three questions I might ask? Especially since why questions, well, why do you feel that way, aren't always particularly helpful. Well, I don't know if you know the reporter questions. There are six questions. Who, what, when, where, why, how. If any of you have taken journalism classes, the reporters are always supposed to ask those six questions. So one way to think about it is if you get rid of the why, so now we're down to five, what, when, where, how, those kinds of questions can be much more helpful. So when you're feeling down, you're feeling depressed, somebody says, I'm just feeling really down right now. What are examples of three questions? Well, it might be, when did this start? When did you first notice yourself feeling this way? When you feel down, what is that like for you? What do you think? What do you feel? What do you find yourself thinking about? Anything that begins to draw them out. And there's two reasons why. Number one, they're stuffing their feelings. They're holding them in. So when you begin to ask questions, you start allowing those feelings that are all stuffed away to begin to come out and talk about it. It feels better, doesn't it? Don't some of you feel better when you finally get to be able to talk about what you are feeling? If you're happy, you want to tell somebody, I feel so good. I'm happy because something good happened. If I'm sad, it helps to tell somebody I'm feeling sad and get some comfort and for somebody to understand and be loving or supportive. So getting them to talk about their feelings kind of unplugs and things, the feelings that are stuffed inside begin to come out. And then they hear that themselves. So often in counseling, I'll have people say, well, gee, that sounded like a good idea until I told you. You know, it made more sense when I just thought it in my head, but to speak it out loud, it sounds crazy. And they'll sometimes say that, is it crazy? And I'll say, yeah, it's crazy, but you do that. Otherwise, you wouldn't have asked me. Well, my parents will be better off without me. Oh, really? How did you first decide that? When did you first figure that out? Help me understand. How is it that you reasoned that out? How have you figured that out? I have a man I've been working with who's been very suicidal, and he told me, he came in and said, you know, I've decided it's just better off, my wife and kids are just better off without me. And so, of course, I'm going to ask three questions, right? So I thought, one question I asked him is, said, wow, how did you figure that out? That's interesting logic. You figured out that the people who love you the most are better off without you. How did you get there? What reasoning did you follow? And when did you first decide that? And how is it going to help your wife and your grown sons? Well, he looked at me like I was the one crazy, right? Like, what am I thinking? But when he started talking, well, in his case, part of it was, well, I just lost my job, and if I kill myself, at least my wife and kids will get life insurance money. So I said, so your family's better off with some money than they would be with you. Is that right? Is that what you're saying? And he looked at me and he said, well, it doesn't sound so good when you say it. It sounded better when I thought it. And part of your questioning and talking to people is to get them to verbalize and hear themselves as well as you. You have to make it safe to talk, too. When you're talking to people when they're depressed and angry, do not violate confidentiality. When they talk about things, respect what they're saying, make it safe. Even if they're mean at you, even if you, like a parent, you have an upset child who comes to you and tells you you are the worst parent in the history of the universe. You're awful. How could anybody be a good kid with a parent like you? It's really hard not to take things personal. They feel like a personal attack. But if you're trying to help somebody who's down and depressed and suicidal, you must relax and let them be able to share what they're feeling without reacting in a negative way. And be honest, that's hard to do sometimes, isn't it? And you have to ask enough questions to really draw them out and get past the anger, past the accusation. When people get this depressed or get suicidal, they often become what I would call be a victim. They feel sorry for themselves. Everything is everybody else's fault. You did this to me. You make me mad. You it's your fault. You make me miserable. What you did to me was so bad. They're a victim. It's like they're helpless, and I'm somehow beating them or hurting them, and there's nothing they can do about it. And when people take a victim position like that, remember we talked last night about helpless, hopeless, and helpless. The victim position is a very helpless position. Well, you're doing this to me. You just have to stop. Like I have no responsibility. It's all your job to straighten out. So a lot of times there's that victim thinking, and that can be really hard to take when people begin to share and blame things on you. I'm the boss at my work. I have about 35 people who work for me. And I get to be blamed for all kinds of things. Because that's what you do, right? You blame your boss. It's always your boss's fault. And so how to be blamed, not take it personal, and then let people talk and try to come up with solutions is much more constructive than taking it personal. And come alongside them. How do you do that? Well, you don't just listen and have a conversation. Be with them. Sit with them. And if there's a time of silence, be silent. But come alongside and walk with them. My favorite picture of this in the Bible is there were two men walking down a road to a town, a village called Emmaus. And they're walking along talking about everything they'd heard about Jesus being killed in Jerusalem, and they're all upset about it. And it says Jesus came out and came alongside the two men walking, and he walked with them and explained the scriptures to them, sat down to have dinner with them, and then they saw it was Jesus. Well, it's that picture of two people walking along the road and then Jesus just coming and walking alongside. That's the picture of come alongside. Walk with somebody. Do some things with them. Let them know they're not alone. You're there with them. And remember, a lot of the really hard feelings last pretty short time, and then they usually start feeling a little bit better. I am so upset. My girlfriend just broke up with me. My parent just died. I just lost a job, whatever it might be. That I'm just feeling so angry and hopeless, and I just want to die. Most of the time, if you walk with people, even just for a couple of days, usually that pressure and that anger and that hurt that they feel will start getting a little lighter for them. And then the next thing you need to do is ask them directly, have you thought of hurting yourself? Now, some people think it's bad to ask people directly if they might be suicidal. And thinking that somehow, if you ask them, you might put an idea in their head that they didn't have before. Kind of like the person is depressed and down, and if I ask them if they're suicidal, like they'll go, oh, I hadn't thought about that before, but now that you mention it, I think I'll think about it. I promise you that doesn't happen. There's a series of myths a paper was written on, and I thought I'd highlight a couple of the myths, the things that are not true about suicide. One of the myths says asking people if they are suicidal might plant the idea in their heads. Do you think that could really happen? I promise you, if you think they might be suicidal, they've been thinking about it a long time before you even caught on. But asking them so it won't plant an idea that they haven't thought about. But I told you the story about Lisa yesterday. A lot of times they may be shocked or surprised that you asked them. But often they're going to be relieved. Because, like, you care enough. You saw that they were hurting and you care enough to ask them a difficult question. So you want to ask directly if they've ever thought about hurting themselves. A couple other myths off of this I thought I'd highlight. One myth is suicide occurs without warning. Everything we've been talking about, say, is it builds. You can see it building in most people, and intervening often can help stop suicidal thinking or development from happening. Another myth here is suicidal people want to die. Do you think that's true? You know, I was sitting around one day and thought, what a great idea. I'd love to die. I think I'll go kill myself. Do you think anybody thinks that way? They don't want to die. And remember the flinching that's in the, they may think about it and back away. They keep it secret. They keep it bottled up. Why? Well, those are all indicators. They don't want to die. Suicidal people want to live, but they're struggling with finding a reason to live in the moment. Another myth, and this is kind of the other side of the spectrum, if people talk about killing themselves, then they won't. Well, as long as they talk about it, that'll make them stop. Is that true? Not necessarily. They may talk about it, but still turn around and try to kill themselves. So some of these myths that people have about suicide can prevent people from doing the most important thing at that point, and that is ask them directly, have you ever thought about hurting themselves? Now, remember the page before the five steps. So if they say yes, they've thought about it, that was step two. The next thing you have to do is find out how much have they thought about it. So remember what step three is? Make a plan. You want to ask them, if you were going to try to kill yourself or hurt yourself, how would you do it? What is your plan that you had? And this is what I did with Lisa, and she told me about the pills with her friend that had lined up. Ask them about a plan. Be very direct and say, how would you hurt yourself? Have you told anybody else about this? but ask about the plan. And if they have a plan, like I used the one example of the boy who was going to jump over the fence hoping the dogs would kill him, that's a different kind of plan than taking pills. Some plans will be more life-threatening and scary, and other plans will not be as thought through yet. But never make the mistake of thinking they're not really serious about killing themselves if they don't have a very good plan. That is not it's just a cry for help, it's not important. Even if they have a bad plan, they still want to kill themselves. I really never think of something as like just a cry for help or just being sad. I take everything very, very serious. So if they have a plan, then you must disable the plan. You have to stop the plan so they can't do it. It won't work. So there's a couple ways to do that. Number one is if they say, I'm going to take pills and kill myself, how do you disable that plan? You get the pills out of there. Now, some pills are more dangerous than others. And I don't know, some things like pills that come from a doctor that are really strong, obviously we know those can be very harmful. Some pills that you could buy in the store or at the pharmacy that appear safe are actually very dangerous. Pills like Tylenol, Advil, ibuprofen, some of those pills, if you take very many of those, they can kill you. Some pills like aspirin, you can take 100 aspirin and it won't kill you, but you'll have a horrible headache and your ears will be ringing for days. So any pill, some pills, even safe pills, pills we might take every day, have the potential of being very, very dangerous. If somebody threatens to drive a car off a cliff, you want to take the keys away from the car for a while. You want to take the plan and disable it. If they have a gun, you've got to get the gun out of the house. If they, whatever their plan that they talked about to harm themselves was, you have to do what you can to disable it. Make it hard for them to kill themselves. For a couple days, they're going to be hurting. They're still going to feel like killing themselves. But now you ruin their plan, so now they have to come up with a brand new plan. Meanwhile, you're going to be trying to help them. So it's a way to protect them from their own threat. The other thing you need to do to disable a plan is tell somebody. Never, ever keep it secret. Even if they tell you, don't tell anybody, you have to disable the plan. Now, who do you tell? Well, whoever you tell should be somebody very close to them. Obviously, if it's a kid, you want to tell a parent, if at all possible. Sometimes you need to tell a loved one, a husband or a wife. Sometimes you need to tell, in our country, as a counselor, one of the people we can tell is the police, and they'll come in. And if somebody is really suicidal, the guardian, they can actually take them. Now, in that case, they don't take them to jail. They take them to a hospital and try to keep them safe. And the law is that, at least in America, I don't know what the law is here, they can be kept in a hospital for 3 days, for 72 hours. Again, think about what I'm saying. Often people are really suicidal, maybe for a couple of days, and then it begins to get better. And that's why they keep them for 3 days, because usually after 3 days, people aren't as intensely dangerous and suicidal as they were when they first went in. But tell somebody. My wife and I, one of our daughters came home from a church Sunday school one time and was talking. And she told us, Bethany told me she's going to try to kill herself. And you remember that? And we asked a couple of questions. Bethany was a girl in her Sunday school class. And Bethany told our daughter, she was going to take pills and kill herself. And, of course, our daughter told us, doing the right thing, so we knew we had to tell the mom, you have to break the secret. You have to disable the plan. I didn't know at that point if Bethany had a real plan. It didn't matter. It didn't care. At that point, we had to disable the plan. I don't remember if it was my wife or I who, but one of us called the mom and said, you know, we have something hard we need to tell you, and that your daughter told our daughter. And so she said, wait a minute, and she got her daughter on the phone with her, and was it you or me? I don't remember. One of us. One of us said, well, your daughter told our daughter that she was going to take pills and kill herself. And her daughter said, oh, no, I never said that. Well, she did. Our daughter wouldn't lie about things like that. And the mom said, oh, no, how, she would never think about that, would you? She asked the daughter. Well, the daughter's dad was absent, and the daughter did have some mental health, other mental health issues. But anyway, obviously, we never were friends with that mom again, and that daughter never did anything, I don't think, as I recall anyway, with our daughter, except maybe Sunday school, but she didn't try to kill herself. So I don't know if it was how serious it really was, but dismantling the plan includes often telling somebody important, somebody close to them. Even if they say, it's a secret, don't tell anybody, you have to tell somebody. And it's good that they know you're telling somebody, so don't even try to cover it up. Don't lie and say, well, okay, I won't tell somebody, but then you tell somebody later. Tell them right up front, you know what? Your life matters. I care about you. I want you to live. I want you to get help. So I do have to tell somebody. And that is part of dismantling the plan. That is part of stopping the series, the five steps from making a plan to preparing to actually attempting it. So we're going to stop there for now. I think it's lunchtime. Russ might want to come up and speak a little bit about then. And we'll pick up here whatever time after lunch that we get back together again. I'll put this emotion chart over here if somebody's interested in looking at it.
Okay. That's a lot to think about, and it is a quite heavy topic. Please don't be discouraged. This is very difficult to think about and to discuss, but it's important. It's important that we consider these things. It is right now a little after 12, and so we're going to go ahead and break for an hour. We'll meet back here at 1 or a little after 1. We'll start again at 1:10. Feel free to eat here. We can pull maybe some tables out if you want to eat here, or if you want to go run over to Dunn's or whatever. Do that as you will. There's a microwave if you need to heat something, and we will see you back in an hour.